Well, good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Today, we are going to have a discussion with three really wonderful individuals who have taken the time to come over to Vanderbilt. And I'd like to introduce them, and each will speak for about 15 minutes. And I've asked all to make sure that we have time for questions, so we really want to finish up by quarter of, and then we'll have time for questions and interaction. So there are three individuals that I would like to introduce. The first speaker, and I'll introduce all three, and then they'll just follow one another. The first speaker is a good friend of mine, Dr. Awad Ben Haizan. Dr. Ben Haizan is a professor of pathology at Meharry. I've known him for a long time. And we've worked together at Meharry in some very productive ways. He actually takes care, among a lot of responsibilities, he's in charge of our the animal care facility there and has speaking about ALAC accreditation. Meharry, through Dr. Ben Haizan, has had it ever since I was there 20 years ago. So Dr. Ben Haizan will speak first on the cultural aspects of Islam. He's a leader of Islam here in the community, here in Nashville. He really is a good friend. Our second speaker will be Dr. Aman Al-Hendi. Dr. Hendi is an MD, PhD, and professor and vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Meharry. And he will share with us the perspective from the point of view of a physician. And we are really honored to have, when I was discussing this opportunity with Dr. Ben Haizan, we are really honored to have Ms. Sharif with us, because I think it's very important that we understand the perspective of the patient, the individual who we might see every now and then. Correct? So I really am so pleased that Ms. Sharif is able to be here. So those are the introductions. I've asked each to speak for about 15 minutes. They'll have a chance to talk with you afterwards, and we'll have time for questions. And we're also taping this in case some of you, I know a lot of the nursing students could not come, in case some of you would like to use it later. So again, I thank you all for your presence, and Dr. Ben Haizan.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and certainly I want to greet you with the greetings of Islam, which are the greetings of peace, which is Assalamu alaikum, as Dr. Hill has just practiced his Arabic there. I'm going to orient you into some basic aspects about Islam, because it will be critical in you trying to understand how to deal with the Muslim patient, that you also have a quick overview about what the faith teaches and some of what that translates into the setting in the hospital and your contact with Muslim patients. Some of that will play out in a hospital setting and your experiences in healthcare, especially as they relate to the Muslim. So with that, and just press arrow, is that right? So very quickly on the terms and meaning. First of all, we've heard a lot about this term. Of course, Islam has been under the microscope lately and over the last few years with some wild events, and certainly Islam is free of those accusations. But know that Islam comes from the root word, which is SLM, and really it means peace through submission. So Muslims attach themselves to the experience of wanting this experience of peace throughout in their lives. And then this willing submission to this one God that in Islam, the Arabic term is Allah, but it really means the one and only God worthy of worship. So the Muslim is the one who practices Islam, and Islam is the religion itself. There are a set of beliefs. Some of those will also be relevant in a hospital or a setting between a physician and a patient. The belief that we believe in the one God, and this one God is termed Allah again. But again, it's an Arabic word that when you translate it, literally means belief in one, and only God. Then we believe in five other things in Islam. The fact that God created other beings that are unseen to us, angelic beings, and that they are revealed books of revelatory status. In that, for example, many people don't know, is the Bible or the Gospel of Jesus, the Psalms of David, the Torah of Moses, the Quran, and so on. So these revealed books. But the books that Muslims adhere themselves and attach themselves to is the Quran, which they consider the last revelation of God. And then there's a chain of prophets that starts with Adam through all the great prophets of such as Abraham and Noah and Moses and all the way down to Jesus, and finally the final prophet, the prophet Muhammad, may the peace of God be upon them all. And then the belief in the last day, the day that we all stand to be accountable about our affairs and the choices that we made on this world. And a very important aspect of our belief is this fate and divine decree or divine will, because this will play out in the hospital setting. For example, this Muslim belief includes the idea that every Muslim's fate is already predestined by the Creator. When you are ill, thank God, all praises be to God. When you are well, all praises be to God as well. That does not mean that you cut yourself off from medical care, but it's the fact that health and illness are all the work of God. And so a Muslim will rely on God in all matters, whether healthy or sick. And that medicine that a Muslim will take really is a vehicle in the understanding of Islam that becomes the cause of curing the disease. But in actuality, all cure comes from God, just like all illnesses comes from God. And so also there are manifestations of Islam, and so some of these would be relevant. This is just simply a word that you say, that there's no God but God, and that Muhammad is his messenger. But one of the things that probably will be relevant is the prayer, because these are rituals that you perform through certain motions of getting up, sitting down, standing, bowing down, prostrating on the ground, and so on. And the other one is the fasting and the pilgrimage. So very quickly, I'll orient you to these. The daily prayers consist in Islam of an individual who stands and then has ritualistic motions of either bowing down and prostrating to the ground. And it's done 5 times a day. Some of these usually catch you when you are at work, such as midday and afternoon prayer. Muslims will ask time to pray if they work for you. But they require ablution, and patients will require contact with water as a result of washing themselves, getting themselves ready for prayer. Certainly requires a quiet, dry, and clean place. Doesn't take very long, obviously. And prayer doesn't stop, even for a sick person, because in Islam, you pray while standing. And if you cannot, you pray while sitting down. If you cannot, you can pray while laying down on bed. So even a patient who is laying down on bed may want to perform prayers, because he or she is not excluded from prayer at all. As you can see in these circumstances, prayers are done at all sorts of situations. This ritual ablution, this contact with water, is a ritualistic aspect of the prayer where you cleanse yourself certain body parts with water. If there's any injury to the external body, such as where there are severe burns to the body, then there's a concept that applies in Islam, which is called tayammum, which is dry ablution, where you touch a dry surface and you kind of mimic the experience of doing the same ritual, but here again, you're not using water. A patient, of course, will require provisions of bathroom, water supply in a jug. And also the contact with water is important to cleanse oneself, especially after using bathrooms. So, for example, you know, those who are bedridden Muslims who are on bed and they cannot go to the bathroom, or who are not, for medical purposes, not allowed to go to the bathroom, even they may require that you provide them with water on their bed so that they can clean themselves from their normal processes of urination and defecation, and then, of course, preparation for prayer. The patient, of course, as we said, may not be able to stand while praying, but certainly in bed, that is something that is important, and they'll continue to do that. And remember that even when you do bed baths, as in some cases that may become necessary in a hospital setting, that these are to be given by the same gender, unless there is no one of the same gender to provide this. Also, the maintenance of the physical structure. In Islam, there's a lot of emphasis placed on the issue of cleanliness. In other words, this comes from the understanding that God is pure and likes what is clean and what is pure. And also the fact that a Muslim must clean their teeth and other body parts, even flossing. These are Arabic terminologies that are used to indicate the dental type of hygiene that one has to have. And the idea of washing after using the restroom, which we have already mentioned. The washing of the hands before and after eating. The other thing is fasting. This is practiced only during a certain time of the year, during the month of Ramadan. You may have come across Muslims who practice fasting. In this exercise, Muslims practice spirituality, increase aspects of spirituality, and a moral exercise. There's an effect on fasting on the daily in the life of the individual, physically and spiritually. There are some benefits. But that know that Muslims may demand that they want to do this even in a situation where they are hospitalized. But there are exemptions. The exemptions of the sick, those who are nursing mothers, for example, those who are not sane, don't have control of their will, all these are exempted. But those who feel well may insist that they want to do this. So remember, there is a diet, and in this fasting, that also sort of kind of piggybacks on the same idea of diet and fasting. The kitchen staff should be aware that Muslims do not eat any pork products at all, whether it become bacon, ham, or sausage, whatever they are, pepperoni, whatever it is, you know, they just don't eat pork products. And we've already talked about the exemptions of fasting. There are two very important holidays for Muslims, and during those days, Muslims may request in a hospital setting that you postpone certain testing, that you exempt them for those days until when they are, those days are not known following the Gregorian calendar, because Islam follows the lunar calendar, and so it changes to shift every year by about 10 days or so. Also, medicines of pork origin become important also for Muslims. Now, I do understand that insulin and heparin most of the time is of porcine origin. But if there are alternatives, then these alternatives should be considered and the individual should be given these alternatives. If there are no alternatives, some sort of explanation and education process becomes important, of course. And if the medication is absolutely necessary, Islam permits it. In the ER setting, know that these rules do not apply. The rule that applies is the saving of that life. That is what applies immediately. So all these are literally thrown out of the window. The Hajj, Muslims will come to you if you are a healthcare provider saying that they want to be vaccinated, be preparing themselves health-wise when it comes to taking this trip. It's a very engaging trip and very taxing on the body, where they gather almost 2.5 million individuals in places of worship that are found in Saudi Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula. So they'll come to you for certain healthcare before they check on this trip. Very quickly on the gender relations, there are very strict gender relations on Islam. Dating, touching, mixing, and free mixing is forbidden in Islam. Of course, for purposes of education, that's okay, and other purposes, work and many other aspects of life. The issue of alternate lifestyle is unacceptable in Islam. Modesty is the norm. This modesty has a wide definition. It's not only about dress. It's mannerism and your demeanor and your character. And it's your attitude towards others as well. So if you look at modesty, Muslims are very sensitive on the issue of nudity. That means when you give them hospital gowns, you need to understand that give them something that is somewhat acceptable according to their standards. And also that they will prefer a gender of the same gender physician and nurse, unless not available. And that also practicing and devout Muslims will cover their head, and I'll show you a picture of that. Unless medically necessary, this should be allowed, unless you certainly want to examine other parts of the body. The room of the Muslim patient, customarily, we teach people in a hospital setting to knock before you enter. Muslim women may prefer to cover themselves before people of the opposite gender enter in. And sometimes people will put a sign, say, knock before you enter. This is always appreciated, especially as it relates to women. And these forms of greeting, I know we are in the South, we like to hug. So that's okay, but you know, be sure that you understand that Muslims do not observe this. The handshaking, look at the cues of the person. Some handshake, some don't, but the majority don't. Some do, so just look at the cues of the person. If they kind of show it to you that they are willing to do that, then you can go ahead, but otherwise, if you just do a verbal greeting, then that's quite acceptable. And also dealing with women, do not assume, ask if you don't know. Certainly know that she may be represented by a relative, the husband. This is not living in a chauvinistic type attitude. It's the idea that the husband takes charge of his family, leads the family, makes important decisions for the family. That consultation is always there, and so don't assume that she should not be making a decision. And she might be very protective of her family, may not reveal a lot of things during history taking, during the time when the individual comes for medical attention, that you must develop your own skills of trying to get the right information. The most common attire you see is this one, as far as dress. And finally, spiritual and pastoral care. Know that Muslims do not accept the cross because they look at Jesus in a very different way as a prophet, and that the cross cannot be used at any given time during the visit, during pastoral care. They may even request that you bring an imam from the local Islamic center. And there are many local centers, wherever you are, in many of the major cities. And sometimes they may request a cross to be removed. I was called to a hospital once, and this patient was becoming very frantic. There's a large cross behind the bed. He was demanding it be removed, but it was engraved in the wall. You had to tear down the wall to remove it. Literally, you know. So we had to do a little bit of education and explanation. It was understood later on, and he was okay. But just understand that they are very sensitive about this. And if you want to see this presentation later on, you can go to our website, Olive Tree Education. There are a lot of classes offered here at Vanderbilt in the spring on Islam, in case you want to learn some more, and that would be a way to get in touch with us. Thank you. And 15 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Benhuizen.
All right, good afternoon. I'd like to thank Dr. Hill for the opportunity to speak to you for the next 15 minutes or so about some of my experiences. And I would really like to applaud Vanderbilt for putting this workshop or seminar together. It really indicates that you are keen on better serving your Muslim patient, which is wonderful. So the title of my talk might be a little different from what you have in your program. I thought I'm going to title it Serving Muslim Patient in America. And just briefly in my background, I'm originally from Egypt. I worked there for a few years. I worked in Europe after that, in Finland, and then I came to Canada, and then to the States. And in the States, I worked for about 8 years in Texas, and then recently in Nashville. So that's where my experience interacting with patients, Muslims and otherwise, is drawn from. So I'm going to briefly talk about impact of Islam on healthcare. Dr. Benhuizen did a wonderful job introducing this. And and then I'm going to talk a little bit about what can we do, how can we improve, and then some resources. I wanted to start by kind of contemplating a little bit on the interaction between culture and religion. And when I was preparing this slide, I was thinking even more. Since I came to Nashville, I came across a lot of non-Muslim Arabs, a lot of Christian Arabs. So that become even more relevant because there's a lot of interaction between culture and religion, as you can imagine. And some of the issues that we talked about and will talk about might be relevant for even some Christian or non-Muslim from the Middle East or from what's geographically commonly known as the Islamic world. The status of women, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. First cousin marriages is very common, for example, in the Middle East and some parts of the Islamic world. You might want to approach this when you're counseling your couples or your patients. Not necessarily very aggressively. I mean, you want to tell them, of course, the genetic facts and so on, but you want to be probably approach it with skills because in some parts of the world this is really entrenched in the tradition and they might be a little offended if you speak too aggressively about it. Male and female circumcision. Male circumcision is mandatory in Islam. So you would expect, and you will see, my gynecology will prevail during the lecture. So you kind of, most of my experience is in the context of OBGYN. So male circumcision, you would expect your Muslim couple to request male circumcision for their male infant. And typically they would like to have it in the first few days. And that's actually medically also a good idea to decrease bleeding. So this is very common. Female circumcision is prohibited and discouraged by Islam. So, but it's very common in certain parts of the world as part of the culture. And that's where kind of culture, you know, might be different from religion. So feel free to talk about female circumcision with the Muslim couple. It's not part of the religion, so you can easily counsel them against it if this even come up. So you need to make that distinction. Acceptance of God's ultimate authority, and Dr. Ben Hazm talked about this. You'll see this sometimes. I see this a lot after intertriant fetal demise, like a stillbirth, and you see the couple have this kind of acceptance. They like to grieve in private. They might not decline grief support groups or emotional support groups. That's not necessarily because of any other reason except that they feel that this is God's will and they have that acceptance. So you need to be aware of that. The family dynamics. Individual patients and extended family may all be involved in support and decision making. And when I say extended family, I mean really extended family. Double digits and so on. So a lot of time it can get frustrating as a physician because your decision might hinge on a call to somebody overseas to help them with decision making. But really, I encourage you to be tolerant to that and to accommodate this, because the family in the Muslim world, and I'm sure in many other parts of the world, work really closely together, and they rely totally on each other for emotional support. So some of these decisions, especially important decisions, major surgeries, things like that, might have to be discussed with several people. Some women might prefer that you discuss everything with their husband. And Dr. Ben Hazm alluded to this, and I know from my experience in Canada and in Europe, sometimes this is perceived as a red flag. You know, even in our teaching and training, we say, okay, now if the husband is overriding and insists on being always there and answering questions, that's a sign of domestic issues and maybe abuse and so on. I really encourage you to be careful with that, and because you might see this commonly in Muslim couples, and maybe the sister will talk a little bit about that. But many times, the domain inside the house is the woman's, is the wife domain, and the domain outside the house is the husband. And visiting the doctors or being in the hospital is outside. So the husband is expected to take the lead, to be protective of his family. I would encourage you to be accommodating to that and not see through this in a different way. And actually, that's also apparent in a lot of literature. And I found this article in JAMA from 1995 saying, for example, the consent form. Well, of course, you provide your counseling to the patient directly. But then I would encourage you to be accommodating to accept the husband questions and help with this process. And that's encouraged in this article when they talk about that when we obtain the consent, we should do it in ways that are comprehensible and consistent with the person's language, customs, and culture. So that really should not interfere with the informed consent process. Communication pattern. Language is certainly important, and that's obvious. So we really need to, especially for new immigrants and so on, who don't master English and might need to be counseled in Arabic or in their own native language. And I know Vanderbilt and Meharry is doing really a good job on that. Avoiding discussion of negative issues, and this really struck me when after working in the Middle East and then coming to North America, that physicians in the Middle East many times don't like to convey bad news directly to the patient. They might give it to another family member, the elder in the family, and so on, and then they rely on those to convey this information. I actually kind of disagree with that, but that's a common practice. Here, of course, we tend to give the information directly to the patient, maybe sometimes in a more blunt way. So just keep in mind that they might be, I would say overreact a little bit or surprised that you're telling them directly bad medical news. Nonverbal communication is very important in the Muslim culture and in people from that part of the world, Middle East and the Muslim world. You might be giving them bad news, but your body language say something else. They might not understand this, or they might feel disconnect, and vice versa. So just be conscious of that. I contact some patients from this part of the world, and again, this is part of the culture and interaction with the religion, that they might not do a direct eye contact. That's not at all a sign of disrespect. If anything, actually, it's a sign of respect. So don't feel offended by that. The love of bargaining, and I see this a lot with women after surgery. They want to go home early, and they keep, you know, negotiating with you and bargaining with you. I think it's just part of the culture, and they will promise to do anything you want if you're going to send them home today. So just be aware of that. Emotional support from the family, and we talked about this. How about religion in a direct sense? As Dr. Ben Hazm said, or showed you similar picture, I just want to show some kind of other pictures, because Muslim women, this is the typical attire, but these are Muslim women's as well. So you might find Muslim women's who do not necessarily cover their hair. So don't kind of totally rely on that to identify Muslim women. Gender difference, gender separation, and this has been alluded to a little earlier. This is common in our upbringing, in school, universities, and so on. If, you know, if this lecture is in Cairo, for example, most likely the men will be on one side, the women will be on the other side. It's just part of the culture. So you know, I've visited Saudi Arabia. They have waiting rooms for men and women separately, and so on. That might not be necessary, but, you know, don't be surprised if you see something like this, like women will gravitate together and men will gravitate together. That's just part of the upbringing. Handshaking was talked about. The healing hands. And the reason I put this there is many physicians, many of my colleagues, and especially specific mentors that I can think of, think that they have healing hands. So they go in the patient room for, you know, post-operative rounding and so on, and they just expose, like the abdomen, for example, is our target area in gynecology, and they just put their hands on that area, and they just keep talking and teaching for 10, 15 minutes. The patient is partially exposed, the hands is there, and they think that's the healing hand that they have. They really do. They think that that's really helping the patient. And I don't know, it might be, but I'm sure many Muslim women might not appreciate this unnecessary touching and so on. And I would encourage you to ask them about this in advance, and to ask them, for example, if you can bring in 10, 15 residents and fellows, and probably anybody, but particularly Muslim women might be more conscious of that. The opposite gender caregiver, as long as it's possible and doesn't interfere with the process, it will be really appreciated. In OB-GYN, we try to do this as much as possible. If we have a female on call that can provide the same quality of service, we always honor this. And the other issues has been talked about. I don't really think that same gender service is discrimination. And so I would encourage you to accommodate this as much as possible. So is there just general consideration on a lot of issues, because we really cannot cover all of this in 15 minutes. But blood transfusion are allowed after proper screening, so no surprise there. Assisted suicide and euthanasia are not permitted in Islam. Autopsy is not permitted unless required by law, unless it's really helpful in a criminal investigation or medical investigation, like of epidemics and infection. Many Muslim couple or Muslim families might not want to do autopsy. There's very high respect for the dead body as much as for the living body. So they might not be willing to do autopsy. So don't necessarily insist on it unless, of course, it is important, and they would honor that most of the time. Maintaining a terminal patient on artificial life for a prolonged time is not usually encouraged, and abortion is not allowed except to save the mother's life. Other kind of bullets, transplantation in general is allowed. Artificial reproductive technology is permitted between husband and wife only during the span of intact marriage. So sperm donation, egg donation is not allowed in Islam. While Islam prohibits homosexuality, it does not at all prevent or prohibit Muslim physicians from caring for homosexual patients. Muslim can give living will and case manager like everybody else, no surprise there. And any genetic engineering-based cure like gene therapy and so on is allowed. And just quickly on specific issues, again, because of my background in OB-GYN, in the perinatal care, obviously this is a very happy, very joyful time in the couple's life. I have seen sometimes after birth, some hospitals give that little booklet with certain names and you know, as a suggestion. And of course, many of these names doesn't have the traditional Muslim names. I found that some couples feel a little alienated by that. So I don't know how to address that, but just be conscious of that. Circumcision we talked about. Contraception is allowed in Islam, and we talked about that. Other consideration, a gynecologic exam in virgin women, you need to be conscious of that. Virginity is very important in our culture and in our religion. When you're examining young girls, just make sure you assure the mother, which will follow you like your shadow when you're examining her daughter. So assure her that that should not interfere with anything, and of course be very careful with that. Use the smallest speculum and so on to not to interrupt any anatomical areas in the hymen and so on. Sexual relationships, sexual counseling, just be conscious of that. Premarital sex is not allowed in Islam. So sometimes we go on our spiel for, you know, safe sex and so on. Just be, show, you know, some sensitivity to that, because young Muslim girls might not appreciate that you assume that they are sexually active. So maybe just ask or be more careful with your counseling in those situations. Of course, also they might not need birth control if they are not married, so just be conscious of that. The birth is a very happy time in any couple's life, so particularly in Islamic culture, it's very important that a member of the child family will usually come and recite certain prayers and certain recitation in the newborn ear as soon as it's convenient with the mother. So just be aware of that and kind of expect that. And arrangements should be made for the circumcision, as I talked about. The death and dying, a dying Muslim prefer to sit or lie down facing Mecca. Generally in the United States, it's northeast. They would really appreciate if you can accommodate this and their bed would be facing this area. This is a sacred subject for Muslims, and family members are encouraged to be in the presence. So you will see a lot of family support at that time. I know this sometimes happens in ICU and might be disruptive, so it should not be disruptive. So medical service takes priority. But if you can accommodate some element of that, that would be really appreciated, because it's important for the dying person to recite the Shahada at that time. And we talked about the grief issues. There will be a lot of recitation of Quran, not very loudly, but it will be audible. So, and I came across some experiences that some physicians were a little annoyed or they didn't know what's going on. It's basically, it's encouraged to recite Quran if you have a dying person. So just be probably more accommodating to that. So what can we do? Respect their modesty and privacy. Maybe some examination can be done under the gown or over a gown without exposing the patient. Dietary restriction, Dr. Hansen talked about this. Inform them of their rights. Many of them are newly immigrants and they might not know their rights. Allow the imam to visit them if available. Do not necessarily insist on autopsy. Allow the family and imam to follow the Islamic guidelines for preparing the dead body, because there's certain ritual that's really important for them at that time. It might be helpful, and I haven't seen this happen in many places, but it might be helpful to identify Muslim patients with the word Muslim in the chart or name tag because of these dietary issues and other issues we talked about. And the issue that necessarily for women, for example, covering their hair might not be the only sign. So you might not be able to tell who's a Muslim and who's not. And there's a lot of help around, healthcare providers within the community, local mosques. These foundations online, Imana is the Medical Association of North America. I forgot what's the Islamic. Yeah, Islamic Medical Association of North America. Sorry, I just call it Imana for the longest time. I forgot the full name. And other sources. And this lecture and the previous one would be at this website after the lecture. And this is the, there's several Islamic mosques in Nashville, but this is one of them, Islamic Center of Nashville. This is the email and the address. And thank you very much.
So as I mentioned, we wanted to make sure that we had an opportunity to have a layperson who's actually also been a patient, as I guess all of us have at some time or other. And it really is a pleasure to welcome Ms. Sharif with us. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum. I am from Ethiopia. My name is Ajibia Sharif. I have three girls. I'm a full-time mom. And today I came to talk to you about my experience in a hospital. But before I start that, I'm going to talk about my daughter's experience in the hospital, because they are young girls. And my oldest one is 18, and my middle one is 16, and my youngest one is 11. You cannot hear? 11. Okay. And the primary care we have is the female doctors. And when we found female doctors, we talked in the front desk that if something happened and she didn't show up, we'd rather have female doctors. But if it's not, just let us know so we can reschedule, you know? And one day it happened, and they forgot to reschedule us. When I do appointment, I do for my three of them at the same time. If I do at 2 o'clock, 2, 2:30, 3, because I don't want to bring everybody different time. I don't have time. So I brought them, three of them, and the nurse took them. She weighed them. That was for physical, you know. She weighed them, and she put them in different room. And then she said, oh, I'm sorry, your doctor is not here. So we said, who's going to see them? She said, a male doctor. And I said, well, we have to reschedule them, because I told you that, you know, you have to put a note on their file that if we don't have a male doctor, we can reschedule and see our doctors. So she said, oh, I'm sorry. And then I told her, I mean, when we told them that because of our religion, we don't want to see male doctors, because my daughters are really prefer female doctors. So they reschedule us, and after that, they really, you know, understand us. And if the doctor is not showing, they just call us and reschedule our appointment. And after that, they understood about, you know, Islam. We educate them, and we've been doing good, and they really understand about people. And I'm going to go through my experience in the hospital. I was breast cancer patient. And I've been in the hospital for almost 2 years with my doctors and nurses and physical therapy, and all of that. They were really good doctors and nurses. They are like a family to me. But it takes me time to explain to them, because the first time I got there, I was a strange person. There are some nurses that thought, oh my God, that lady, you know, she's here, because they don't know me, because all the time they give me the gown, it's my nightmare, the gown is my nightmare, because I don't just like it, it's too short, and, you know, and all the time I tell them I wear tight, and then I put my gown on the top, and they said, Ms. Sharif, why are you doing this? And I told them, I'm really serious. I explained to you why. But, you know, just give me the big one if you have really big and long one. You know, I don't mind to wear it, you know. But they said they don't have the big one. So they get used to me, because I'm everybody is different. But this is my, you know, Islamically, I don't want it to be, you know, short. And then culturally, when I never be, you know, without clothes in front of people. You know, I have to have something, and then the gown on the top of the clothes. So for them it's a little bit strange, but they did understand me after that, and nobody bothered me, believe me. I go with my scarf, and if I have to take the top, I will take the top off, but I do have something, you know. And they did understood me. But the first time when I was diagnosed by breast cancer, I really have hard time to find a female doctors, you know, because it was so quick and I don't know what was going on me. You know, I was so scared and I just said, okay, this is an emergency. I just have to go through whatever they told me, you know. Then I start asking, there's a lot of women doctors here, Muslim doctors. And they said, you know, we can find some if you ask. And then I start searching in the computer and I found one oncologist, the best one in Nashville. But unfortunately, she cannot take me because she is full. So that's why I went to the male doctors. But right now, because my situation is better, I start changing, you know, my male doctors to female doctors. And I am doing good. If you have any questions, physically, you know, that's all I have.
Can I say something? I forgot to say
about pork. I spent in a hospital about 10 days, and I explained to them why I'm not eating pork. I explained to them because I'm Muslim, I'm not eating pork. But each morning, the pork is there. But one day I have to call the person in charge. And I told her, I thought you put it in the computer, you know, when I said I don't want to eat pork. She said, oh, we forgot, you know, we will fix it and we will get you your food. And after that, they start giving me. And then I found a lot of friends, nurse friends over there. You know, one of my nurse friends said, the easy way is just to tell them you are allergic. Because I complained about, you know, the pork, and I told them, why don't they, you know, they give me pork. I don't want to eat pork. They said, maybe they forgot. And she said, just do what you have to do. And thank you for listening to me.
Wonderful. So we have, first of all, I really want to thank all of you. We all appreciate you taking the time and your candor and the information that you shared. It's very, 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 very important. Deep perspectives. And before we have questions, can we thank them again? Because I think it's okay, so we'll have some time for questions, and I'd appreciate it if you could make your questions short. Please.
I'm the one that made it was part of my presentation. Yes, we believe that all illnesses, all sicknesses, all diseases are things that God has already made in existence or has put into existence on earth. Some of them may have happened 10 years ago, 100 years ago. HIV wasn't there. Now it's here. This was all parts of God's plan. That's why that plan is playing out. So is the treatment. That the treatment is also out there, because the Quran assures us that with diseases there are cure, but we have to research for those cures. So then mankind is left to identify what these diseases are, as well as identify the cures. Yes, we also believe that in the divine will and predestination, everything is written for everyone on earth about what they will be, what they will not be, what disease they will have, how they will die, what suffering. Everything is pre-known or already in existence with God. He is aware fully of what will be and what is to happen.
But if I may just comment, I mean, that doesn't at all discourage people from taking all preventative measures, seeking medical help, and you can remember from Dr. Ben Hazm's presentation, Islam stressed a lot of prevention. When you think about sexual transmitted disease or cleanliness and how this helps preventing many diseases. So all of this is built in. But yeah, if disease happens, there's that feeling of acceptance that this is pretty distant in a way.
Okay, I think I see what you're trying to ask. Well, some of the scholars have talked about this, and they say that this is a way of God dealing with whatever human being he wants to deal with in whatever manner he has determined. There are some who are given some things and some suffering and some handicaps on earth, and then on the day of judgment and in the hereafter, they are blessed with a reward of some kind. All this is part of that, detail of equation that we really don't know all the answers to, but the answers lie with God.
Can I give some comment on that?
I work with families who have loved ones with disabilities, specifically children, for the most part. And when a Muslim family calls me, and I offer the traditional resource that we have, a support group and various therapeutic options, I often feel like I haven't helped them, truly. Is there something that I should know culturally as a resource in the community? Mostly families want to be connected, and as you were talking about being very private and grief and so forth, it tends to be a barrier for me.
Okay. Well, the resources are there in the community. A lot of these Islamic centers will have individuals who can counsel families, meet with families, provide some sort of support. And many of them may already be coming from one of these Islamic centers that they are affiliated with, unless they are new to the area and they maybe don't know anyone. So I would urge that, or recommend that you probably get in touch with the centers, find out if the imam can come or someone else, a representative can come for assistance in your situation. But yes, so that's available. And it should be easy to get hold of that.
Well, not really, because it's part of the development. So, you know, I have two boys, and one is 16, one is 12. The 16 now is very conscious of this issues and talk about it and so on. A couple of years ago, that didn't make any difference to him. So I don't think that's an issue until you hit puberty and that become more important. So.
Yes, please.
Let me say a few things, then maybe Dr. Al-Hindi can add on that and the sister can add on that. Actually, what you're saying is not necessarily entirely true, because, for example, the issue of the scurf, they did a survey not too far back, about a couple of years back, for those who were born here, children of immigrants, first generation, and even second generation. And they found that these girls or these ladies, over 85% of them prefer to cover as part of their attire. So what you are trying to allude to may not necessarily be the truth of the matter. And if when they were studied and further questions were asked about their preferences in life, like, for example, would they date, would they freely mix, would, you know, those things that we talked about, again, it fell in the same sort of understanding. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want to, because my own children were brought up here. Dr. Al-Hindi will tell you, his own children, Sister Jabia, her own children were brought up here. But you'll find that it's already playing out in our children. They don't practice these things because that's how they were. And we have seen that even with second generation. This is not to say there are not a few individuals or quite a number of families out there that maybe are not as strict. True, they are there. And so, but again, I really feel like the majority, even what he showed in terms of the various pictures of how some of them dress, that where they don't cover, it is true. You'll see that here in the States. But when it comes to certain things, you'll find that they still don't eat pork, they still don't, they're careful, they want the same gender physician, you know, and so on. They don't cut themselves off from that just because they don't cover.
Yeah, and if I just add quickly, you're right in that sense that some of the things I talked about are culture and some are religion. The religion-based things probably not going to change, like what Dr. Ben-Hazim said. The dietary, the alcohol, the prayers, and so on. Some of the cultural things, yeah, might be diluted out a little bit or and so on. So, but really the core values and the core practices probably will be the same, whether you are born and raised here or you are an immigrant. So, I don't know if the sister wants to add anything.
My children are born here, but they still know what they should do and what they don't, you know. When they have physical therapy, when 18 years old physical therapy, my daughter is a virgin. And she told them they cannot check her. And they said, you came for physical. Why? She said, there's nothing happened to me. And then the question they were asking her was strange to her. Every time they ask me to leave here over there, she can answer. But my daughter is telling me, you can stay here. There's nothing new, I tell them, you know. So when they ask her, and she just keeps saying, yes. The last question they ask her one day is really irritated me. Do you love a girl or a boy? And she said, and I told her answer. And she said, probably a boy. But it happened, didn't happen. You know?
Later.
It didn't happen. She has to think about it. She paused and think, and she said, probably a boy, because it's not allowed to love a girl. And then I told her, you know, why are they asking this kind of question? She said, Mom, you know what is going on in here, you know? So they have to make sure. That's for everybody. But it's really, I mean, different when you see Muslim girls, and you have to respect and see them, you know, what they want. That's all.
Go ahead.
I have a question. And I guess all of you refer to the fact that if a same-gender healthcare provider is present, is available, then they should be present. Well, what do you think is the responsibility of an institution, whether it's our institution or the Harry or Baptist or whatever, to make sure that the same gender healthcare provider is present?
Well, I mean, I have a friend of mine who's working in Detroit, in Michigan, and where they have a huge Muslim community in parts of Detroit. And that became an important issue. And, for example, in the OB/GYN ward, there's always a male and female on call, two attendants, every night. I really expect that to be an issue when you have that kind of volume and need. It become kind of impractical if you have few patients who would, you know, take advantage of this kind of opportunity. So you really have to study your own situation. If there's no availability, I mean, it become more like a customer service, really. Like, I mean, what we did, we told them the situation. Like, if I have a chief resident female, and OB/GYN, it's nice because a lot of the residents now are female, so there's always a female around, and she's competent to do the same service, then I would, you know, she would provide that. But it's probably impractical to expect that every hospital in every community, if they have, you know, few patients who would take advantage of the service, to accommodate this.
If a Muslim woman presents in an emergency room
as a victim of domestic violence, does Sharia law have conflict? Do they have a specific way that that's dealt with versus just what our legal system would say, how that victim has to be dealt with? Is there a separate, do you understand that question? Is that circumstance treated differently with regard to Sharia law? Is there a specific way that would be dealt with?
Well, I can comment from the emergency room procedure, and then Dr. Ben-Hazem might comment on the Sharia. I mean, the emergency room procedure should be exactly the same. I mean, you attend to this patient, you gather as much information as possible, you attend to their immediate medical needs and any, you know, pressing medical situations. I don't see any difference, really. The only thing I would caution about is some of the stereotyping and some of the preconceptions. But as far as the actual evaluation of the visit, it should be done in the same normal routine.
And when it comes to the what you're referring as Islamic law, which is Sharia law, of course, the Sharia law provides for the fact that abuse should not have been there, and the fact that it took place, then other measures need to be instituted immediately. Now, what we usually say is that the laws of the land can be applied in those circumstances. But it would be wise to incorporate other forms of services in the community, such as in the Islamic centers, where either an imam or somebody competent from the center can come in and provide counseling and other forms of direction in terms of how to resolve this. Yeah, finding the root cause, for example, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Thank you again so much for being here.
Very well. Absolutely ask. I mean, don't assume, because, I mean, I tell, you know, it happens occasionally that, you know, I have a Muslim patient and I'm the attending oncologist, even when I was a resident, but particularly when I was attending and we are teaching a resident, and I tell her, you know, I'm not going to be around to deliver your daughter, you know, in 30 years, and so we need to train. So they would be open to that. They would be open to medical students and residents from the opposite sex having an opportunity to interact with them and to learn and to acquire the skills that they need. So, I mean, they are very reasonable, but I would certainly ask, just the actual act of asking and giving them the charge of their own body and their own visit and their own environment would be really appreciated. And many times if you explain it, that would be okay. So that shouldn't be absolute. You should always ask and discuss it.
Well, as I said, we've taped this session, so if any of you would like to get a hold of it, just contact my office. I want to thank everyone for coming. I really appreciate it. Let's thank our guests.